This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Issues of diversity and equity are top of mind for many candidates, including ones for school board.
Representation matters, right? But, you know, I'm aware, you know, sometimes of where we live, that it may not be as easy.
Here, Unit 5 school board candidates talk about enhancing teacher diversity. Plus, one of Governor J.B. Pritzker's executive orders has put a chill on malpractice lawsuits. Here, a graphic report. A mentorship program in Bloomington Normal is providing new opportunities. And the Illinois State University Food Recovery Network is receiving national recognition. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. McLean County health officials report 106 new COVID-19 cases as the county's testing positivity rate rose a half a percentage point to 5.4%. The positivity rate had not broken 5% since late January. Wednesday's daily case count is the highest in the last 9 weeks. The number of McLean County residents hospitalized with COVID-19 held at 30, but hospital bed capacity tightened to just 6% of all Bloomington Normal hospital beds open. That is less than half the capacity reported Tuesday. There are 440 county residents isolating at home, bringing the active caseload to 470. Legislation aimed at closing loopholes in the Illinois gun regulation system will be reintroduced this year. State Representative Kathleen Willis, a Democrat from Chicago, says the bill will require fingerprinting and background checks for all gun purchases.
I think everybody, no matter what side of the debate you may be on gun ownership, would recognize that there are people that should not own guns.
A similar measure introduced last year failed to get a vote in the Senate. A Bloomington City Council candidate says it's time for tough conversations about policing, immigration, and other hot-button issues. Patrick Lawler is running in Ward 5 on the city's Near East Side.
Just because we are willing to engage in those conversations does not mean that we are creating that tension or that stress. We are merely kind of bringing it to the fore.
Lawler says there may be areas where council members can find easier common ground, like on ways to improve downtown. His opponent is Nick Becker. In his business, he says he often plays the role of peacemaker. Becker says it's key to not only understand what the opposing side thinks, but why.
If both sides do that, generally we're closer to the right answer.
The election is April 6th. Early voting is underway. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA continues its educational video series, Hear My Story, with local patient Robert Handley.
The providers at Bloomington Normal Audiology are all doctors of audiology. They have gone that next step, so they're medical professionals.
Robert's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's public media. Issues of diversity and equity are top of mind after a year of renewed calls for civil rights and social justice reform. Some of those conversations center on American schools, what students are taught, how they're treated, and what their teachers look like. Dana Vollmer talks with Unit 5 school board candidates about how they plan to address equity and diversity.
Candidate Kentrika Coleman says data clearly show an academic achievement gap between minority and non-minority students in the district. It's not unique to Unit 5, and Coleman says it came before the pandemic, though that's not helping. Coleman says her top priority is addressing that gap.
I am confident, that every student has the ability to be successful and reach their individual fullest potential, no matter their circumstances, right? But this is something that I realize can't be done without community and our parents, caretakers, and educators all coming together to make it happen.
Coleman says she wants to see more students of color enrolled in dual credit and advanced placement courses. She also wants to see teachers better reflect their classrooms.
I do think representation matters, right? But, you know, I'm aware, you know, sometimes of where we live, that it may not be as easy to have, you know, a pipeline of folks, of diverse candidates, right? What that means is that we would have to be very creative in how we address that representation fact.
Coleman says there's no single solution. She says it will take collaboration from the entire community to solve these problems, but it also needs to be a concrete part of the district's strategic plan. Coleman is one of two Black women running for the board. The other, Erica Ralston, says Black and brown parents often feel ignored.
A lot of parents that I've talked to over the years, even not being a school board member, but going to some of the meetings, they feel like they're not being heard. So I want to be that ear. I want to be the person that that listens.
Ralston says it's a vicious cycle. Lack of diversity on the school board and in a meeting audience makes the room feel less welcoming for parents and students of color.
Sometimes when people don't see enough representation of a certain group of people, they shy away. They don't want to be involved because it's not enough representation of a certain group of people. So my thing was building relationships. I believe that the school board has got to get out.
Ralston says the district needs to make diverse families comfortable enough to be in the room to advocate for themselves. Candidate Stan Gozier agrees the achievement gap between minority and non-minority students is a big challenge for the district, state, and country to overcome. He says investing in all students early in elementary school helps them succeed later.
This is where students are most impressionable, more impressionable than at any other age, and they're coming in with the widest range of needs. They can be special education needs, they can be social emotional needs. They may just be remedial to get up to the point where they are at grade level and build those reading and writing skills so that that can further self-propel their education into the junior high and high school levels.
Gozier says it's also critical that teachers and administrators foster inclusive environments for students. He says this requires constant learning and an acknowledgement of the social issues faced by students and their families. Gozier supports the Illinois State Board of Education's culturally responsive teaching and leading standards. Those emphasize training new teachers about systems of oppression and how they impact education.
All it's doing is declaring certain standards that we would like for all of our teachers to work in a society where everyone gets respect and everyone gets that opportunity to fully understand each other's perspective and appreciate each other's perspective and how they get to the table.
Opponents of those standards dismiss them as progressive political agenda and yet another unfunded mandate. Candidate Jeremy Dehy says he's not necessarily against the standards, but has some concerns about implementation.
I think teaching students alternative histories is a very important thing. You know, the history that was taught when I was in school is, you know, it's a very one-sided view of history. And I think we need to teach our kids about the good, the bad, and the ugly of our history. And that's important. But doing so in a political fashion is frustrating.
Dehy says yes, Unit 5 administrators, teachers, faculty, and staff should better reflect the diversity of the community they serve. But he says recruiting those teachers is difficult amid a teacher shortage. Dehy says his approach to school policy is simple. Students come first. He says that's regardless of race, nationality, sexuality, or religion.
Racism, oppression, I think those are horrible things that we need to, if we can implement part of the education system to mitigate those or reduce those. I think, you know, ideally eliminate those, but even reduce those is a very important thing.
Another Unit 5 candidate emphasizes a need for more diverse curricula. Gavin Cunningham is running on that theme.
I am really dedicated to starting a subcommittee of parents, students, teachers, staff, and community members to reform our current K-12 history curriculum. And I think that it's crucial that each and every one of our students that graduates have the resources and the knowledge of understanding and knowing American history outside of just what has been taught continuously for the past few decades.
Cunningham says that means teaching Juneteenth and accurately describing relationships between Native Americans and European colonizers. He says it also means developing Black history beyond pared-down stories of Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. Cunningham says the benefit is twofold.
More more diverse teachers would be interested in coming to our district if they see that we are trying to make our curriculum more diverse, because the way that it's taught right now is a very whitewashed version of American history.
Candidate Janelle Sipar did not respond to WGLT's request for her stance on race-specific issues, but she says legislative pushes to make teachers and classrooms more inclusive can be redundant. She says those efforts are already happening.
As a teacher, you get trained through your schooling, and part of your education revolves around the fact that you don't pick the children that walk into your classroom. You need to meet them where they are. And that includes every possible life experience that led to making the person that they are coming through that room.
Sipar says there's room to improve access to the school board and decision-making that affects all families.
I think that we're going to see some interesting changes going forward in the world as a whole with this edition of Zoom that we're using today, because it allows people more opportunities to get together in a short, convenient fashion.
Election Day is April 6th. I'm Dina Vollmer.
You're listening to 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Changes made during the early stages of the pandemic are having long-lasting effects on the legal system. Back then, Governor J.B. Pritzker signed an executive order to make it harder to sue healthcare providers for wrongdoing. That was supposed to protect providers amid a surge of COVID cases. Eric Stock reports one Central Illinois couple says they had a terrible experience at a health facility, but because of the governor's order, they can't find an attorney who will take their case. A warning, some of the details in the story are graphic.
David Taylor of Fairbury contracted the coronavirus last March. He spent 3 weeks on a ventilator. He couldn't walk or lift his right hand. His speech was poor. He couldn't remember his own family. When Taylor got out in April, he needed rehab and went to Kindred Hospital in Peoria. Taylor says he had a wound near his tailbone. It kept getting worse. He couldn't see it, but he could smell it. He says he kept telling hospital staff and they ignored him.
Nobody's telling me anything at all. I cannot get any information from anybody. And they seemed like they just wanted to keep it very quiet.
Taylor weighed 300 pounds before he got sick. He lost 40 pounds but had little strength. Staff had helped carry him to the restroom. Taylor says staff wouldn't let him use the bathroom.
They said, that's what we do here. We change sheets. So you just go to the bathroom in bed, and we'll clean you up later. Well, that is absolutely asinine, in my opinion.
Taylor says he got almost no physical therapy in the weeks he spent at Kindred. And Taylor says the wound was so bad he couldn't sit. Taylor says a physical therapist there told him they weren't set up to handle someone of his size. David's wife, Marcia Taylor, says the wound kept getting bigger, and staff did nothing.
It was so big, and I'm not exaggerating. We had a new grandson that week that I know I could have fit that little baby inside that wound.
The wound became infected, and that put him back at Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal for surgery. Kindred Hospital CEO Christopher Curry says he can't comment on the specifics of any patient case due to privacy laws, but he said in a statement to WGLT, Kindred, quote, takes seriously any issues brought to our attention and works with the patients and families to address their concerns. Curry adds Kindred is taking all appropriate safety measures during the pandemic. After all that, David Taylor says he looked for an attorney to sue Kindred Hospital for malpractice. He says nobody would touch it because the governor's order providing legal immunity to healthcare providers during the pandemic.
The lady, when she called me and to turn it down, she said, normally we would be all over this, but because of this, we're turning you down. I said, okay.
Some personal injury attorneys say they haven't taken any malpractice cases since the governor's executive orders because they don't stand a chance. Jim Ginsky is a personal injury lawyer in Bloomington.
Healthcare providers obviously needed to be focused on providing the care that they needed to provide to infected patients as opposed to worrying about subsequent lawsuits. So I understand, quite frankly.
The governor's order expired in June. The federal government offers limited immunity through what's called the PREP Act. It applies only to countermeasures a facility takes to address COVID. Volunteer healthcare workers have some liability protections under Good Samaritan laws. Bob Panton is president of the Illinois State Medical Society. He says he wished the governor had extended the executive order further, even though most hospitals now have a manageable number of patients.
The State Medical Society is appreciative of the liability protection that was provided in those months, and we certainly think some of the conditions still exist.
Panton says the executive order particularly helped hospitals convince retired medical workers to come back to serve. Retirees typically don't keep liability coverage. Not all malpractice filings have stopped. Some attorneys say they are busier now than a year ago, in spite of the governor's order.
That does not scare us.
Megan Shore is a Chicago attorney that specializes in malpractice cases, particularly involving nursing homes. Shore's firm filed a wrongful death lawsuit against a Bloomington nursing home and a rehab facility over a resident who had died of COVID. Shore says state and federal laws don't protect medical providers who show gross negligence or willful misconduct. She says she's seen that far more often in nursing homes. She says many are chronically understaffed.
We don't think that nursing homes should get away with this and use COVID as an excuse to not provide care. And I'm seeing it all over.
Attorney Jim Ginsky says he believes some cases in which COVID patients suffered organ damage will likely go forward. He says the bigger injustice COVID had caused is the effective closure of civil courts for a year. There's now a logjam of cases. Ginsky says civil cases that would usually take a year or two to go to trial may take 3 to 4 years. And he says that often helps defendants run out the clock.
We have had over the years cases where we've had to throw in the towel because a critical witness died. The longer the delay, the greater the chance that you're going to lose critical evidence.
David Taylor still has photographic evidence of how badly his body was damaged from the neglect he suffered at Kindred. Taylor says he also took his case to the Illinois Department of Public Health. Taylor says the agency told him since he was no longer at Kindred, there wasn't much they could do for him. The 61-year-old Taylor is on disability from his job in office technology. He tries to see the bright side in all this.
Life goes on. And I would say that you have to think that way. I'm alive. I survived it.
Taylor says he survived because his wife got him out of Kindred. He says he still has a lot of health problems. He has limited lung capacity. He struggles with balance, and he can barely lift his left leg. Taylor says he's not sure how much of that is because of COVID or the kind of care he received. I'm Eric Stock.
Illinoisans who win personal injury and wrongful death lawsuits could soon get higher payouts in verdicts. The state legislature has approved a bill to tack on interest to the payment amount from the time the lawsuit is filed rather than after the verdict. The measure awaits the governor's signature. This is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's public media. A former Bloomington Housing Authority resident created a space to encourage students in the community to achieve goals they might not have been confronted with before. Student reporter Cameron Kelly has this story.
Andre Hersey's community work began with the Boys and Girls Club of Bloomington Normal and later the Western Avenue Community Center. A few years ago, Hersey took a leap of faith and created the Jewel Foundation. It's a nonprofit teen enrichment program that provides academic, educational, and mental health support. It's now entering the second year of a growing mentorship initiative with the city of Bloomington.
There's not a lot of culture here in this town. These kids don't get exposed and don't get opportunities. And I think a lot of times when you can give them that, it makes a huge difference.
The Jewel Foundation debuted in 2017. The next year, Hersey was the adult recipient of Normal's MLK Human Relations Award. Today, his foundation works with students from sixth grade to seniors in high school.
It has to be about the kids in order for it to be successful. So I just really wanted to give these young folks an opportunity to be exposed, opportunities to get outside of Bloomington and explore different cities, different states.
Kajian Tate is a graduate member of the Jewel Foundation and now a sophomore at Alabama State University. She received help through the program even after leaving college. Tate recently applied for a job and her and staff were able to get her a letter of recommendation. When needed, Tate hops on Zoom to help out with the foundation and mentor students.
My favorite part is just being able to watch him teach other kids and help other kids grow like us and just multiplying in his organization.
A reward for students involved in the Jewel Foundation holding at least a C average in school is being able to go on trips. Students who are struggling to get their grades up have an opportunity to get tutored through Illinois State University. And the Jewel sign-up process also gives the option for families to consent if a student needs an advocate when a parent or guardian is not available. More recently, the foundation has found success with its mentorship program in partnership with the City of Bloomington, which began last year as a pilot. Young people with Jewel are placed in various city jobs, including Parks and Rec, the Water Department, City Administration, and the Pepsi Eye Center. There are 4 positions in the mentorship program's first year, and that is expected to grow up to 20 in year 2. Here's Bloomington Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus.
Exposing young people to government as a career. You know, I will tell you that governments across the country, frankly, are struggling to attract minority students. Governments across the country are also struggling to attract a younger generation because there's so many options and opportunities out there to do other things.
The partnership brought young people into city government, but also helped them make long-lasting connections and build their resumes to help in future endeavors. Taya says the mentorships are more than just a summer job, and they also pay real money, unlike unpaid internships that can be a barrier for some young people.
I think that it was important to show participants that we were serious about this. First of all. Second of all, you know, young folks need money and they do. And so, you know, we want it. When you talk about the whole attaching a carrot to a work program, we wanted to do that as well to make this more attractive to kids who maybe hadn't heard of government as a career. The final thing for me is we needed to put our money where our mouth was and is. If we're talking about how it's important that we have diversity, if we're saying it's a priority, then I think it's important for us to act like it.
Andre Hersey says internships and mentorships are beneficial for kids to see beyond Bloomington.
I've always told them, I expect for you to go on and be very successful in life, whatever that looks like. I said, but one thing, you don't owe me anything, but just make sure you reach back and help the next person out that may be struggling.
Kids staying involved is important to Hersey because it keeps them focused in on their future careers and educational goals.
Especially for brown and black kids that look like me. Once you do that and you position them for those type of opportunities, I think there's a lesser opportunity for them to get into some trouble.
Young people can register online to enroll in the Jewel Foundation. I'm Cameron Kelly.
The reporter on that story, Cameron Kelly, is part of WGLT's own internship program run in partnership with the Illinois State University School of Communication. This is Sound Ideas. An Illinois State University student organization is getting national attention for reducing food waste. The ISU Food Recovery Network chapter collected the most leftovers of any similar group to provide meals to those in need. Student reporter Katrina Peterson talks with ISU catering chef Phil Cade about the impacts the ISU Food Recovery Network had on world hunger and climate change in just the last year.
So it looks like from the beginning of the pandemic, it looks like 2,100 pounds of food.
When it comes to landfills and waste, what are conversations that the ISU Food Recovery Network have about CO2 emissions?
So 2,100 pounds basically is 40,000 kilograms of CO2. That's something. You know, it's not a massive amount, but it is something. It stops it from going into a landfill. I mean, here at ISU, we have pulpers and extractors and things like that. So that takes 8 pounds of food and sucks all the water out of it or all the moisture out of it and breaks it down into 1 pound of food that is then used for compost that we send them as Midwest fiber for compost. And that's another service we don't pay for because they get the compost for free. And I think we're heading in the right direction. There's obviously more we can do, but the electricity, I guess 4,000 kilograms of CO2 is the equivalent of electricity consumption of an entire household.
Are there some other actions that ISU Food Recovery Network has taken or are going to take to address landfill abundance?
I think the big push is really working to get our to-go containers to be all compostable, which we're moving to that area. But the big thing on campus now is how to dispose of those containers. Because just because something's biodegradable doesn't mean that you can just throw it in a plastic garbage bag and then it goes to the landfill all tied up. So you have to have air that can reach the biodegradable products. And so if you're tying it up in a plastic bag and throwing it in a landfill, it's not going to decompose. Getting the containers and the trash containers and the students trained to know which containers to put all those in, I think is going to be the next big push you're going to see over the next year or so.
Recently, the ISU Food Recovery Network chapter received a letter from the national organization letting the students know their chapter was the top food recoverer for 2020. What does that mean, and why is it such a milestone?
One out of eight families, basically, has a food shortage right now, food insecurity in America. Yeah, I just think every little bit helps. You know, it goes to show that if a pound of lettuce that didn't go out in front of customers and scraping the salads and things like that and just saving those little bits of the food, they add up.
The Food Recovery Network as a whole has more than 140 participating campuses, and since its founding has recovered more than 4.9 million pounds of food and reallocated it to those without food security. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.